inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
Welcome to The Lynn Show, and I am the Lynn of The Lynn Show. You're listening to me on what I assume you know is the Radio Ear Network. You must have chosen it, because you can't possibly have found it by turning the dial and landing on it accidentally. So you must have landed on it other than accidentally, and I am certainly glad that you're here with me. I'm assuming that it is 1 o'clock Eastern Standard Time on Tuesday afternoon for you, or if you're on the West Coast, it's 10 o'clock, or if you're in Nashville, and if you're listening, hi Terry, it's, I think, noon there. And also, this show is broadcast on Monday morning at 3 a.m. for those of you who might want to listen in a country other than the United States. So if you haven't heard the show before, let me tell you a little bit about what to expect, beside meanderings about the time. I wrote a book called When You Can, You Will, which is about why people can't always do what they want to do when they want to do it. We live in a culture whose conventional wisdom tells us that we can, to use Nike's words, just do it. It seems to me that we are in love with that word, just, and if we put it in front of a sentence, things which had previously been impossible now become not only possible, but ought to be easy. And if we don't just do it, then the conventional wisdom tells us that we either didn't want it enough, or we didn't try hard enough, or there's something wrong with us. And we start to call ourselves all kinds of names. Well, I think that that is just nonsense. I think that there are really, 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 really good reasons why we can sometimes not do the things we badly want to do. Sometimes we just can't do it. But that, it's almost a shame to admit in this culture that you couldn't do it. And when actually, I think I remember there was a phrase, right? There's no such thing as can't. Well, that's blatantly absurd. every single one of us, and anybody who's listening to me and myself and everybody we know, has had the experience, whether they admitted to it or not, of wanting to do something which they simply could not make themselves do. You wanted to lose weight or stop smoking or quit school or go back to school or leave your husband or marry your boyfriend or tell your girlfriend that she hurt your feelings or call a parent on something that they did that embarrassed you, clean up your room, not clean up your room. You know, it doesn't actually matter, but the thing is, we've all had the experience, observed it in ourselves and saw it painfully in others, of things we just couldn't do. When you can't do something, you've tried. I don't mean to suggest that you shouldn't try. I'm sometimes accused of trying to tell people that they shouldn't try. I don't ever do that. Try. Some things are hard to do, but trying makes them so. And you know, and the work is worth it. But if you have tried and you can't, then there's a very good reason that you can't do this thing, whatever it is. And I have observed this for a very long time, the 30 years of my private practice as a psychotherapist and many more years than that of living my own life and observing the lives of my friends and family. And I know some things, I believe, about why we get stuck, what it is that gets between us and making the changes in our lives that we want to and sometimes need to make. So I wrote a book about it, called When You Can, You Will, which is the truth, you see, I think, or I believe anyway. Until you can, you can't. I'm going to say it again because it seems hard for us to get it. Until you can, you can't. And when you can, you will. So the book is filled with examples of reasons that we get stuck. And one of the things that I do on this show is talk about those things, the things which get in our way, get between us, and the changes that we want to make in our lives. I also play music, my own. If you were listening at the front of the show, you heard a song that's on my CD, and there'll be a song at the end of the show that's also on my CD. And I play the music of other people, some that you will have heard of, that have been played on the radio, and some are the CDs of friends of mine who, like me, have made independent CDs that are not signed to record labels, and you can't get them in the record stores. But when they're available, I will let you know how to get them, because some of them, well, not some of them, all of them are terrific, or I wouldn't play them. But if I don't give you a specific way to get in touch with the artist or to get the CD, you can always get whatever I talk about on this radio show, either by emailing me at lynnburnfield@gmail.com, that's Lynn Burnfield, one word, or going up on my website, which is The Lynn Show. You can get my book or the workbook that is a standalone, has all these exercises in it, or the audiobook from me. You can get, actually, you can click on my CD and get that there too, but you can also email me for anything that you hear on the show that you might want to get. So for the last few weeks, I've been talking about the family and how experiences with our family of origin get in the way sometimes way later in life, and that we can often, usually, most of the time, trace whatever it is that's stopping us in the present to something that happened in the past. In the last show, I was talking about modeling, that is the ability of children, actually the compulsion of children to copy or model their parents. You know, I also want to say you can get podcasts of the previous shows, because I sometimes refer to things which I've talked about in the previous shows. And so if that ever piques your interest, you can go up on the website and download the podcast. So last week I was talking about modeling, how children copy, how we all copy our parents. And I talked about modeling the same-sex parent, which, although there are sometimes dilemmas attached to that, is the healthiest thing that we can do. And today I'm going to talk about anti-modeling, or modeling the opposite sex parent, which a lot of us do. We think that it's kind of standard, you know, little girls grow up to be like their mommies, little boys like their daddies. But very often we model the opposite sex parent. We will do that when either the same sex parent, there's something about the same sex parent that turns us off. That person bothers us, upsets us, embarrasses us, scares us, abandons us, hurts us, right? Then we may, and we'll often do, identify with the other parent who happens to be the opposite sex. But this can also happen if the opposite sex parent is really attractive, really charming, or really scary. We can also identify with the opposite sex parent in those cases. And while it's always the smartest, safest thing to do when you do it, and you do it, you know, when you're very, very, very young, it can have problems. So I'm going to talk about what some of those problems are. And after that, I'm going to play the second half of an interview that I did with a brilliant, more than talented, dear friend of mine, Michelle Brauerman. I aired the first half of the interview last week and played two songs from her CD, and I'm going to do the same thing this week, that is, play two songs from her CD and air the final half of her interview. I'm beginning to do a series on anatomy of an artist, what it takes to be an artist in this culture. What is the experience of people who have really given their life to their art? Mostly, I see as I am proceeding that I'm talking to musicians, and that's probably because I know a lot of them. But I'm also going to talk to artists and dancers and writers. And actually, if you are a working artist in any of these fields and you would like me to interview you about your experience, please go up on my website or go to my email address. The website, again, The Lynn Show, and say, I want to talk about what this is like, and we'll get together and I'll interview you. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about anti-modeling and how, if you happened to model a parent of the opposite sex, how that might be getting in the way of what you want to do with your life today. When you identify with an opposite sex parent, even though it's the best possible choice at the time, it can cost you a great deal in later life. When you reject a same-sex parent, and that's what you're doing when you're identifying with an opposite-sex parent, you're rejecting your same-sex parent. Well, when you do that, you're rejecting something essential about yourself. We all instinctively know this. So when you identify with an opposite-sex parent, you may feel out of sync. You may suspect that there's something bad or flawed about you. Now, that something is the characteristic that you can't help sharing with the same-sex parent, the one you rejected. This something you believe is bad and have denied even to yourself. Unfortunately, as an adult, you may find it is precisely this despised and disowned quality that you need to make the change you want to make. And this is what happened to a client of mine, somebody I'm going to call Belinda. Belinda came to see me because she was having panic attacks. In enclosed spaces, she would suddenly have trouble breathing or feel as though she was going to have to faint. Sometimes she had to pull off the freeway and wait until it passed. She described herself as a, quote, self-sufficient woman. She was not at all, she stressed, like her asthmatic mother, who had been totally dependent on her father. Belinda had always felt sorry for and even been embarrassed by her mother. She'd identified with her, quote, independent and successful father. She'd been successful herself. She was a good businesswoman. She learned all of these things from her dad, and she used them really well. She'd always thought that she would get married, but somehow she never found Mr. Right. At 33, although she didn't recognize it, Belinda was ready to recover a quality she had anti-modeled or disowned: her ability to trust. Her self-sufficient role had served her really well, but it had cost her. In her terror of becoming dependent like her mother, not her difficulty finding Mr. Wright. That's what had kept her from marrying. Before Belinda could marry, she had to know that trusting a man would not lead to losing herself the way her mother had. When Belinda felt her own urge to trust surfacing, she's sort of yearning to be in a relationship, it reminded her of her mother, and it triggered her mother's asthmatic symptoms. In therapy, Belinda began to think differently about her own ability to trust. She began to understand it outside of the context of her mother's dependence. When she realized that she could allow herself to experience her ability to trust without having to take on her mother's other characteristics, such as her asthma attacks, her fearfulness, and her total dependence, Belinda's panic attacks stopped as quickly as they had begun. And about 6 months later, Belinda found her Mr. Wright. Now, having to accept that you are in some way like a despised parent can be a really powerful obstacle to change. If in your family pie, and here I want to say that, as I mentioned last time, if you didn't hear the show in which I described the family pie exercise, that show, and actually I think there are two of them, can be had on my website. And if you're interested in pursuing this whole issue of modeling and anti-modeling, a really quick, easy sort of cliff note way to do it is to check your family pie. And in order to do that, you have to know how to do it. So you can check your family pie, and if you see that you share no qualities with your same-sex parent, or you've written many of the qualities that you wrote in your pie piece in the pie piece of your opposite sex parent, then you have almost certainly identified with your opposite sex parent. And this means that you are denying aspects not only of your same-sex parent, but of yourself, because you can't help but have identified with your same-sex parent before you had words. And that quality may be the very one that you need to claim to make the change that you want to make. And this doesn't just happen to women. A client I am going to call Roger loved his dad, and his dad loved him. They shared many interests, and they spent a lot of time together. Roger was treated very well by his dad, and he had no reason to be angry at him or to disown him, so he identified with him. But Roger's father was abusive to his mother. He was constantly critical of her, and he didn't even try to hide the fact that he cheated on her. Roger also loved his mother, and he felt responsible for her. He had a real dilemma. He had identified with his dad, but he didn't want to be the kind of person who hurt mom. Roger solved this problem by modeling his father in every area of his life except one. He never got married. Without realizing it, Roger feared that if he married, he'd become just like dad and hurt his wife. When Roger was 40, this choice became a problem. He wanted to get married and saw over and over again that relationships would fall apart, and he just had real trouble. You know what they call commitment phobia? He finally had to confront his dilemma. If your same-sex parent was someone you loved and admired, then you probably did model yourself after him or her. But if that parent also had qualities you despised, you may be stuck in a double bind until you understand that you don't have to take the whole package. This is something we as children don't know. If we identify, we think we have to take the whole thing on. In your family pie, you may find that you share all or most of the qualities you've attributed to your same-sex parent. There may be, however, one or two traits that you absolutely don't want. So, how can knowing any of this help? Well, first, what have you been doing while I've been talking about this? Have you been thinking about yourself and your life? Have you been wondering who you might have identified with and how much of the qualities that you learned from that parent you are using today? And is there anything about your opposite sex parent, or your same-sex parent for that matter, that you really didn't like? You know, was somebody loud and boisterous and embarrassing to you, or dependent, or sick, or did somebody abandon the family, or, well, you know, I mean, it, we can dislike all kinds of things if they come in the right context. So if you look at that, you look at those qualities, just write them down. You know, I, for example, my mother was always bragging about how much money my father made. I'm making this up because my mother didn't do that one. Just write it down. And then be on the lookout for whether what you're calling bragging is something you either do or don't do. Maybe you need to ask your boss for a raise. And in order to do that, you need to be able to say, hey, I'm doing a terrific job here. And that might feel like bragging. And that might remind you of having to stand there and listen to your mother brag about how much money your father was making and how embarrassing you found that. Now, that information in and of itself can be really useful if you understand that your reluctance to brag on yourself when it's necessary is not just something out of the blue, you know, oh, I'm just like that, but that it is something that you have denied because it showed up in a parent you didn't like. Now, that may be enough to allow you to risk that. If not, and you're in therapy, then you want to discuss it with your therapist. Or you might just want to discuss it with your siblings, because another sibling might be having the same issue. I know that in my family, several of us are dealing with the same kinds of issues. And when we talk about it amongst ourselves, it's really helpful. I've said in earlier shows, and I probably will say again, that I think interactions with siblings, talking with siblings about what went on in the early years is really useful. They are our best allies, our siblings, because they were there. They had the same experience. And I don't know whether you will have this experience or not, but my sister and brother and I remember different things. For my mother's 70th birthday, we wrote her a book called I Remember. It was a blank book. And we each went off into our respective house and wrote down all the things that we remembered about my mom. And then we got together and we wrote them in the book in different ink so that she could tell who was writing it. And if we remembered the same thing, then the person who wrote it would write the, for example, I remember that my mother made Friday night dinner every Friday night. And if my sister and brother remembered that too, then they would write me too, in the bottom. But there were lots of things that only one of us remembered and that the other ones had forgotten. And my mom died, almost exactly a year ago. And I found that book on her night table. And I read it, and damn if I hadn't forgotten some of the stuff that I had remembered. So, you know, talk to the people in your family who you feel close to and share whatever feels safe to share. And I'll talk more about how knowing about modeling can help you change. But now I'm going to stop talking because I've been talking a very long time. And I'm going to play a song from Michelle's CD, which is going to come before the rest of the interview. And this is so wonderful for me because this song is about anti-modeling. This song is called The Ballad of Robin and Marian. And it's the ballad of Robin Hood and the Maid Marian, but not the conventional one. And if you listen for it, you can hear that Maid Marian did not identify with her same-sex parent. And it caused quite a lot of distress for her in her life. So, okay, the ballad of Robin and Marian, followed by the interview with Michelle. I hope that you enjoy this as much as I did, both listening to the song and talking to Michelle.
Marion escaped to Sherwood every chance she got to rally with the men in Lincoln Green. Nottingham was rotten and she was simply not the kind of fancy waiting on the Queen. She'd saddle up her mare and ride like the wind, feel the mist of Sherwood burn against her skin, longing for the day when Richard ruled again and Robin could ride free beneath the sky. Marion would wonder why women learn to smile and curtsy and pretend to be afraid. She wanted bows and arrows and lessons with a sword. She hated every time they called her maid. She'd fasten up her skirts to practice her skills, mastering her courage, strengthening her will. She would fight beside him, she would even kill, so Robin could ride free beneath the sky. His ransom paid and came to claim his throne. Robin got a title and estate. He married Lady Marian with the blessings of the crown, then rode away on Richard's last crusade. And Marian would pace the grey castle halls, staring at the tapestries she'd hung upon the walls, knowing she was saddled with a lady's protocol. Robin could ride free beneath the sky. Know how she yearned to gallop through the night and carry desperate warnings and take chances with her life and see her outlaw spirit in the mirror of his eyes and once again ride free beneath the sky.
For a record deal in the early 70s in New York, you know, and meeting all these A&R people, some of whom really loved what I was doing and some of whom said, well, I don't see a market for this. But no matter what, most of them had this philosophy. I remember was that one of them put it, you know, the cream always rises. In other words, if what you do is good enough, you will wind up, you know, successful. I'm sorry.
Really?
That is just such a crock.
That's right.
There are so many creamy people who are walking around who have not been heard or seen or recognized. That's just a crock. But you buy it. You think, oh, that's true. So it's like social Darwinism backwards. You think, if I haven't been successful, I must not be very good. And then you see people who are really successful who think that they're not. Look at Joni Mitchell. She thinks she's having a terrible career. I don't believe it, but she does.
Well, and then there's Janice Ian, who actually I heard say in an interview that myth that an artist must suffer.
Yeah.
And if you're not suffering, you're not an artist.
Does she believe that?
Apparently.
Oh, Jesus.
Right, exactly. But I think the point that we're making is that there are so many myths about what it takes, what you have to be, and really that none of them are true. Every possible route to success, however impossible, you know, it is to conceive of, that has been made. And then there are hundreds of people who have done what they were supposed to do, all the things they were supposed to do, and it didn't work.
And there are thousands of people who set out with tremendous dreams and tremendous talents who are now, you know, doing carpentry somewhere or selling real estate.
Yeah,
or
what's the line from Do You Know the Way to San Jose? Washing cars and pumping gas?
Well, that, or doing other things that are meaningful, not necessarily washing cars
and pumping gas, not necessarily
waiting tables, but who have built other careers, you know, have just gone on and said, geez, that's really, that's not my path. And the talent is still there and dormant, you know, or being exercised in other ways.
Because I work with writers and artists for a very long time, seeing the pain of not being able to do the thing, you know, missing it.
Or not being able to sell the thing. You can do the thing. I mean, you know, really, nobody can stop you from sitting down with your piano or your guitar or whatever, writing a song or getting your brush out and painting or sitting at your computer and writing a novel. Nobody can stop you from doing that.
And that, it seems to me, is the most important thing either one of us has said today. To value the thing and not to surrender it because you can't make a living at it.
Right, yeah, don't buy into this doesn't have value because it's not earning money. Just don't buy into it. It's not true. It may have enormous value. Mozart was buried in a pauper's grave, you know, in a common grave, in a pit with 100 other bodies. And he was Mozart.
You know, I worked on a musical version of Cry of Players, which is about Shakespeare. And I was explaining to my therapist that I was working on this project, and he said, well, why did you choose that? And I said, well, you know, there's Shakespeare, you know, all of the, everything is against him. You know, he comes from a family that doesn't have anything to do with art, and he marries young, and he has to escape from his family, and he struggles, 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 and then he's Shakespeare. And so my therapist said to me, and if he hadn't been Shakespeare, well-known, should he not have written? And of course, that's the point.
That's the point, is you don't know that you're Shakespeare. Mozart knew that his music flowed from some source. He knew it was beautiful. I bet he knew it in his body, you know, just the way I think I know things in my body. Mm-hmm. But he received very, very little acknowledgement.
The real question for each of us, I think, is if you have an artistic passion, can it be enough for you?
You know, and I think the answer to that is, well, yes and no. Because it's hard to keep making art in a vacuum. If you're writing songs and nobody hears them, what does that feel like? I mean, you can stack your manuscripts in the barn like Charles Ives did. He knew that nobody really wanted to hear what he was writing at that point in time, and he still needed to write it. So he invented life insurance, and then sold life insurance so that he could support himself very well, and he continued to write his music, and he literally just, you know, would finish a piece and he put the manuscript in the barn.
But again, this is the dilemma of the artist in our culture. If you are not making a living at your work,
what do you do?
What do you do?
How do you manage? How do you find the energy?
No, and that
brings
us...
How do you find the energy and time to continue to do what you need to do and support yourself, and God forbid, support a family?
And that's...
Or if you're lucky, support a family.
No, exactly. And I want to say, because this is particularly... Well, I don't know, maybe it isn't. I want to say this is a dilemma for women who have children.
It's a dilemma for women who have children, but it's a dilemma for men, too, who feel that incumbent upon them, they have to be able to support a family. I saw that just slam into my ex-husband, my first husband, because his passion was writing music and performing his music. And he didn't see a way, given the skill sets that he had, he didn't see a way that he could do that and support himself, let alone a partner or kids. And that really cost him. That cost him a huge chunk of his spirit.
Yes, and I think it costs however you do it, you know?
It costs however you do it, but I mean, I sort of made choices. I just said I'd rather live more simply. I'd rather do with less. I'd rather buy my freedom to continue to do what I love to do. And I'm willing to live, you know, fairly frugally in order to do that.
Well, and also...
And I've also, though, been lucky to have partners who had some money coming in, too, so that made it easy for me to say that.
You know? Well, and you did these other things that you didn't particularly want to do.
Yes, I did.
You know?
And actually, most of those things have wound up being the things that opened doors, because if I'd been able to just stay home in my own house, in my sweats, you know, writing music, I wouldn't have found the avenues that I've found for the work that I've created, so... oddly enough, the things that I didn't want to do that I was doing with some reluctance or even embarrassment have been the greatest gifts that opened other doors. I was accompanying Amanda McBroom at the old Blah Blah Cafe, which has been a great boon to both of us. I can't even tell you how many different ways. But at that point, Dixie Carter, who knew Amanda, came in and saw what I was doing with Amanda and called me and asked me to work with her. So I worked with Dixie as a musical director. And later, when she started to do well with Designing Women and wanted to do a yoga video, she had me score the yoga video, which wound up being at Universal, which is why I got the job doing the Land Before Time movies. So look at those steps, you know? I mean, I guess if I've learned something because of that, it's take all your steps and keep your eyes open to all the windows that are around you.
Yeah.
And one thing for an artist that you maybe don't want to do is hide in your house and, you know, just write your music or paint your paintings. You've got to have some avenues that pull you into the world, even if they don't look, I'm sort of thinking out loud here, but even if they don't look like the avenues you had in mind, all those doors are windows, or all those windows are doors, or something like that. They're there. And, you know, one way or another, you find ways of meeting other people or being heard.
I think that's a very good place for us to stop. And I'm looking forward to the time when we can have the interview about Dangerous Beauty. And thank you very much, Michelle.
Thank you, Lynn. That was fun.
And that was the multi-talented, multitasking, very wonderful, terrific friend, Michelle Brauerman, who, as you can tell from listening both to what she says and to her work, can do just about anything there is to do with music. She can write it, music and lyrics. She can arrange it. She can produce it. She can play it. She can sing it. She's magic when it comes to music. She's also a terrific human being. And I'm going to play one more song from her CD, Fools and Little Children. And this song is called My Favorite Year. She wrote it with Karen Gottlieb as the lyricist on this song. I met Michelle and Karen the very same day. They had also come from New York City to Los Angeles to see if they could launch themselves in the elusive career we were all attempting to launch ourselves in. Karen's an amazing lyricist, as you will hear from this song. And this song has been covered by a number of artists, but the best version is the version you're about to hear. And so I'm going to play My Favorite Year.
Could go back there, would we stay? after all the loves I have lived through all these years, I had to go so far without you. Now it's clear you were my favorite love. That was my favorite year. You were my favorite love. That was my favorite year. La, la.
God, I still have almost 20 minutes of this show, and talking after that seems like yelling in church. Wow, Michelle. Well, maybe I'll talk a little bit about L.A. I recorded that interview with Michelle in Los Angeles. I was in Los Angeles for 2 weeks. And, of course, that is where I met Michelle and Karen at that time. I was visiting. I thought I was visiting. I didn't realize I was moving. I was visiting Los Angeles, and I had gone to ASCAP. I'm an ASCAP writer, and I wanted to meet some producers or A&R people or something. And all they wanted to introduce me to were these two New York songwriters, these women who were also trying to do what I was trying to do. And I didn't want to meet them. They were not what I was there for. But I didn't want to offend this guy at ASCAP. And when he called them and said he was sending me down, they didn't want to meet me either. But they also didn't want to offend him. So they said, oh, sure, send her down. So I went down, and I met them, and that was 1974, and that was a real gift he gave to us, making us meet each other. I lived in L.A. for 20 years. I moved in 1994 after the 1994 earthquake. It was in L.A. after beating my head against the entertainment wall for a very long time that I decided to do actually what Michelle was talking about. I'm not sure whether it was in this week's interview or last week, about finding another place to use my talents. And so I went back to graduate school and became a psychotherapist and stopped writing for a very long time. Music, that is. I wrote the book, of course. although I now live happily in Sarasota, Florida, which is heaven, but you didn't hear that from me. I get to spend a lot of time in Los Angeles because my family is still all there, and my private practice, which is all on the telephone, and most of my clients are in Los Angeles, so when I'm there, anybody who wants to come in and see me in person can. And also, I have many friends still in Los Angeles, and I recorded the CD in Los Angeles. Michelle produced it for me in a studio there, a wonderful place called Grandma's Warehouse, with Andrew Bush engineering, and terrific musicians. And it took a very long time because I was running back and forth to LA, and we had to coordinate my travel schedule, Michelle, the musicians, the studio time. But it was an amazing experience for me, and one I'm hoping to duplicate fairly soon. So I spend a lot of time in L.A., but don't tell anybody. I don't like L.A. anymore. I did for a very, very long time. And I have to say, L.A. was very generous to me. It gave me many, 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 many gifts. But it finally became more trouble than it was worth for me. And that Northridge earthquake was really the straw, as they say, that pushed me over the edge, to mix a metaphor. And my then-husband and myself owned a house in Sarasota, so we came to the place where we had a house. And boy, that was another gift L.A. gave me. like the proverbial mother bird knocking the baby out of the nest. It's probably not an exact metaphor, but that is how it felt. And again, after all the wonderful gifts that L.A. gave me, it gave me a boot, and I wound up in this terrific place. And I didn't lose L.A. in the sense that I can go back there and stay with family and see my good friends. The Lynn Show is proudly being brought to you by Louise Hamel of Prudential Palms Realty. Louise is a real estate agent who specializes in bringing the world to Sarasota and Sarasota to the world. So if you've been sitting at home in Canada, the UK, or Europe, listening to me talk about how wonderful Sarasota is, and you think you might like to get a piece of this, please visit Louise at her website, louisehamel.com. Or in the United States, you can call her at 941-780-7474. Louise routinely wins awards for customer service, so you know you'll be in good hands. It's Sarasota Real Estate for the global market. And again, you can contact her at louisehamel.com. That's one word, louisehamel.com. And while I'm giving credit, I need to give credit to one of the people who make this show possible for me, and that is my IT guy, Josh Hackney. I'm fond of saying that Josh is young enough to know everything there is to know about computers, recording, electronics, and he's old enough to know the importance of customer service. So if you have issues with any of these things, you have questions, you have problems, you have new equipment you need to set up, he set up my phone system, and there's really nothing Josh can't do. So if you have any of those concerns, you should call Josh. And you can call him at 863-990-8349, or you can email him at Josh C. Hackney. That's one word. It's JOSHCHACKNEY at yahoo.com. Or, if I said that too quickly for you, you can always email me either through my email address, lynnburnfield@gmail.com, or you can go up on my website and email me through that and benefit, as I have, from the talent and kindness of Josh. So I'm going to wrap up here the idea of modeling, copying, identifying, imitating, and anti-modeling, anti-copying, anti-identifying, and how what we do with that influences our life and what we can do and what we think we are capable of, and how it may get in the way of things that we want to do later in life. Today I had several people at my house for a gathering, a meeting. It's a group I belong to, and they going to have a meeting, and I offered them my house. I offered them my house because I like to do that kind of thing. I like to entertain. I like to cook. I like to serve. I just like it. And I was saying to one of the women there that this is a way in which I modeled my mom. Now, I did not model my mother in a lot of ways. I didn't live the life she lived. I didn't marry young, have children, have the traditional, housewife life. And I didn't live the life that she wanted to live. She wanted to go to college, and she wanted to be a teacher, and that wasn't possible for her. And she, boy, she tried her damnedest to make it happen for me. But I, they were fond of saying that the very first real rebellious act of my life was not majoring in education. So I didn't live either the life she led or the life she wanted for me. But I did model her in this way. She was a great entertainer, really loved it, was good at it. And I used to help her with it, help her set up, help her prepare, help her write down. I started entertaining at home before I moved out of my parents' home, and continued to do that and continued to enjoy it and to get a lot of pleasure out of it. And I was explaining this to one of the women at the event, and she said, oh, my God, I'll bet that's why I don't do it. She said, because my mother didn't do it, and I always have the vague feeling that I'm not going to be good at it, that I'm not going to know how to do it. This is not a particularly young woman, and she said, you know, lately I've begun to risk that maybe I can. And I've had some people in, and I've done some small entertaining, and I have found, to my astonishment, that I am good at it. I can do it. And, of course, this is the perfect example. If you have identified with a parent who didn't do something that you later in life want to do, you may not think you have it in the repertoire. You may not think that it's there inside of you. And it may be. You may have developed the skill, but our idea of who we are is so linked to the person that we identified with that we can be limited by that, even when it isn't really true. And this makes me think of something that I call the great trait swap. I talked about it several shows back, and of course you can listen to that show by downloading it from my website, or you can read about it in the book. The great trait swap suggests that if there is a trait in your system, that is, that it exists in anybody in your family, that it exists in everyone in the family, so if it exists in the system, it exists in you. But if it isn't in the person you identified with, you may not know that you have it. In fact, the chances are good you're in denial for it. You don't believe you have it. So again, if a change you want to make requires a trait which it doesn't belong to the person you modeled, but does belong to someone else in the family, you may not know that you have it, but you have it. You can use it. And this information, in and of itself, can be really useful if you think in terms of what it is that you want to do, and what characteristic or trait you might need to make it possible for you to do this. Do you think that you need to be braver? Do you think that you need to be more assertive? Do you think that you need to be more timid? Maybe you are in relationship with somebody that you've been scaring and you want to back off a little bit, but you don't think you know how. Well, if there's anybody who's timid in your family system, you know how. You're just in denial for it. As I've been talking about this, I've been thinking about the song I played earlier, Michelle's gorgeous song of the Ballad of Robin and Marian, and I introduced it by saying, you know, Marian is a class example of a woman who didn't identify with her mommy, because certainly in the culture that she lived in, the women didn't do what Marian wanted to do. And so it's pretty clear that she identified with her father, who was perhaps a knight and did all those wonderful things, and that she wanted to do them like daddy. But of course, there was no place in that culture for her. I feel safe in saying that Marian's mommy would have been happy to be waiting on the queen and probably wanted Marian to do it and to be happy doing it. And you can see how at the end of the song it cost her. Because while in that period of time that everything was in flux, she could do that. She could take those risks. But when everything went back and she got married, well, then they expected her to do the woman thing. Now, I want to make the point here before I run out of time, which I am rapidly doing, that I am not saying there are roles, sex roles. I'm not saying there's a woman thing and a man thing. I am saying that whatever it was that the parent that you identified with did, God, what a convoluted sentence. That is what you think you can do, should do, feel comfortable doing. But it isn't all that's possible for you. And it may very well be limiting you in ways that you don't need to be limited. So, ask yourself, what is it that I want to do? And what characteristic do I need to do it? And did the parent that I identified with, did they have that? And maybe there's a question before that, which is, of course, which parent did I identify with? Did I identify primarily with my same-sex parent or primarily with my opposite-sex parent? Am I a hybrid? I'm kind of a hybrid. And again, being able to take a little from column A and a little from column B, that's terrific. That gives you so much more latitude. But if one of your parents had qualities you really didn't want, then even the qualities they had, which you might have wanted, may have become unavailable to you, which is to say you may have denied them. Because in an attempt to disown those things you didn't want, well, you just shoved all those things that you did want in the same box and didn't realize that you can pick and choose. Well, okay, we're running out of time here. And so I'm going to say that this has been The Lynn Show, and I'm coming to you on the Radio Air Network, and that I will be back next Tuesday at 1 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, and that I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper I may have gotten